Hello, and welcome to The Filibuster, the podcast of the Union University Political Science Department. I am Seth Brake, the visiting assistant professor of political science, and I'm here joined by Sean Evans, the chair of the political science department. Dr. Evans, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for hosting, Seth.
So today we want to talk about a national tragedy that has some political implications. So we're here to talk about the assassination of Charlie Kirk. So before we get started, I know it seems like a bit of a silly question to say right now with how much publicity this is getting, but we don't know when people are listening to this. So do you want to tell us just very briefly who Charlie Kirk was and what happened to him?
Yeah, so Charlie Kirk is known as a right-wing influencer. He got his start as an 18-year-old trying to reach out to college students. He ended up creating an organization called Turning Point USA, which has been there to try to promote free speech on campus to make sure conservative ideas are heard there. They have also tried to identify professors on a watch list who they said were hostile to conservative students and conservative ideas, which made the group somewhat controversial in some circles. He has turned it into more of a political organization that raises money, runs campaigns ads, and has been especially important in the 2024 election as a important part of the Get Out the Vote organization for the Trump campaign.
So his death was a very violent and public moment.
Yeah.
Right. He was assassinated while giving an address. What has the reaction to this been like?
Well, I think for those who like Charlie Kirk and have been impacted by this, they see this as the tragedy that all murders are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are those others who are his opponents. Most have been respectful, but there are a few people who would have been better off if they paused before they hit the submit button on what they say. But I think the consensus position of most people in the United States that this is a tragedy.
Yeah.
And we need to do something to make sure that we don't have tragedies like this again.
So let's start with the most important things here. As Christians, how should we react to the death of a public figure? I mean, how should the way we speak about them, how should the way we think about them in light of these events, how should that change?
Yeah, I think as Christians, our first response should be, this is not how God meant for this to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we look at it from that perspective, we are reminded that we are fallen human creatures. We are reminded that this is the way God never intended it for be, which in ways can be a impetus for us to rededicate ourselves to doing what God has called us to do in whatever we do. But we also have to remember that we are reminded of the frailty of life, that we are here for a limited amount of time, and that we should be thankful for the time that we have, and we should be thankful for the people who have been important to our lives, and we should make sure that they recognize how important that they are. But the final thing we have to remember as Christians is that death is not the end. Death is the beginning. And so while death comes with grieving, it also comes with joy. And so for Charlie Kirk, who was a Christian, he is living the abundant life that God wants for all of us now, that he is with his Creator. And so, yes, it's a horrible tragedy, but this is not the end.
So on that point, we introduced him as a conservative right-wing influencer, but also he has this part of his public persona, which is being open about his Christian faith. As Christians, how do we process these two identities? How do we think about that? I mean, there are some people who are saying that he is a martyr for the faith. There are other people talking about how this is a specific moment for evangelical Christians rather than for conservatives. I mean, how should we process that?
So, first of all, I would say that as Christians, we have to remember what our vocation is. And so our vocation is not we're Christian and we're something else separate. The two are fused. We have been gifted with talents and skills by God, and He has called us to do certain things. And so what we need to remember is that our faith is not separate from our calling, and that we should be doing everything we do as unto the Lord by doing it with excellence. But yes, we should also find those opportunities to live out our faith and to tell of our faith when the opportunities present itself. So I would hope we don't think of this as dual, that they are connected to one another. Having said that, I am a little bit skeptical about calling him a Christian martyr, because a Christian martyr is someone who died for the cause. And in what I'd say was Charlie Kirk's instance is that he was engaged in a political event. And so I would suggest that if he's any kind of martyr, he might be a political martyr. But then I'm also a little leery about using the idea of the term martyr in this regard. Though, I mean, I will say the assassination of him was not just an attack on him. It was an attack on our democracy in the sense that he was trying to engage in open debate with others. And that free speech, that open debate, is essential to what our constitutional republic is built on. And this individual who shot him decided that he got to decide whether Kirk's speech was valuable or not, and that's not for anyone else to decide. That is to be decided in an election, whether people have been brought to his side or not. But the idea of all speech is valuable, and we should try to promote that if we're going to have a successful democracy, including the ideas that we disagree with, so that we can come to a better idea of, A, what is the best thing for us, two, to make sure that we recognize the humanity of each person and their ideas, and three, to make sure that we don't accept things just because that we have been told, but that we engage with ideas, wrestle with them, so that we know what we believe and why.
So that actually transitions nicely into something else I wanted to ask. So free speech obviously is an important part of this conversation. You know, Kirk was killed in the act of political speech, but also he had founded an organization that was dedicated to speech in some ways. So let's get back to the fundamentals. Why is free speech important to democracy?
Yeah, so, I think first and foremost, it is important for elections. The idea is we are trying to choose who's going to represent us. And so we need a free exchange of ideas on what policies are best and the traits of a candidate so that we choose the right person. Second, I think it is important as a matter of accountability. When we do not like what is going on, we should have the right to tell others that we don't agree with it, so that if others agree with us, that we can mobilize more people so that we can get better people in office in the future. So if we limit free speech, and remember, that's exactly what most government officials would like to, so that their voice is heard, then that is a danger to our democracy in that regard. Yeah. And I think also the speech is a way of making connections with others. It is about, in a large country like ours, how do we make connections with people who are different from us? Hey, if we find that people across the country agree with our ideas, that makes connections to us. And even if people don't agree with our ideas, the fact that we have a same interest in politics provides a connection which allows us to have further conversations. And this is what's important to creating a national identity.
So Is this murder a threat to free speech?
Yes, because Mr. Robinson decided that Kirk's speech was dangerous. And we have to remember that all speech is dangerous on one level, but not in the way that the shooter thought. Because every idea can be a incitement to do something good, potentially also something bad. But the idea is, ideas are powerful. Ideas have changed the world. I mean, we're in a nation that's built on famous phrases like, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These ideas are what help us see ourselves as one, and it has motivated our actions to where we've realized at times we have not lived up to those ideals. And yet this gives us the opportunity to say, hey, how can we try to meet those ideas? So speech is important. The things that we believe motivate us to do things that are bigger than ourselves. And so that makes speech very important for reasons other than what I've already mentioned.
No, that makes sense. So let's talk about the other side of the coin then. After, like you said at the beginning, after the killing, some people said some things they probably shouldn't have. A lot of them got fired. A lot of them lost their jobs. Rather famously, very briefly, Jimmy Kimmel was taken off the air. Is the reaction also a threat to free speech?
Yes, because what we are seeing going... So most of the time when we think about threats of free speech, we think of the First Amendment and its limits on government. And so what we have to remember is the First Amendment is designed to prevent the government from restricting speech, because political officials only want the speech that makes them look good out there. And so that's why we don't want that. But we have to remember, throughout history, some of the biggest restrictions on speech has not come from the government, but from the public, who says, we don't want to hear ideas that we don't like. So the idea that we have people going around and firing people for the things that they have said is potentially a threat to free speech. A lot of what people have talked a lot about in the past 10 years is political correctness and cancel culture. And people have said that this has been used especially to try to quiet conservative voices. But this cancel culture idea can also be used to quiet other voices, and we want to make sure that there is a free flow of ideas from all sides if we're going to find out what is correct or not. Now, having said that, when you do stupid things, there are consequences for those things. Now, the question about whether people should lose jobs or not, I think there's several things we have to take into account. Our first response, I think, as Christians, should always be pause. We realize that we are fallen people, and sometimes we say stupid things. And so I think the first thing, if when someone says something that we think is incorrect, our first response should be, why are you saying this? Mm-hmm. I think we should try to understand the motivations of the other person, why they are saying this. And then if they have views that are different than us, we need to be asking about those views. But we also have to ask them, why are they making the comments that they do? And I think that leads us to have a conversation with them about how what they said can be taken the wrong way. I think when people say the bad things, it should be a teaching moment more than it should be a punishable moment. And so I think this is an opportunity for us to talk to people about what is good and bad public discourse. Because one of the things we see today is that our political discourse is very troubled. And so I think we should go in trying to see things from other points of view, being willing to forgive. Even if we can't see it from their point of view, I think we should be willing to forgive. But I think there are some instances to where we have to say that perhaps you should be punished for what you have been said. But even if it comes to that, I think what we have to look at first is government should not be punishing people for speech. That's not their job. That's what the First Amendment is for. And so, for example, I think when Brendan Carr, the chair of the FCC, threatened the broadcast license of ABC if they did not pull Jimmy Kimmel off the air, that is a bridge too far. Because if the right does it, the right's not going to always be in power, and the left is going to do that. And even if you think the left has already done that, you're going to have a lot better opportunity convincing people that they shouldn't do it if you stand on principle instead of just sheer politics. The second thing I would say is, even if someone has done something punishable, the first goal should be rehabilitation. But then I think, depending upon the context and who you are, that's going to have an impact. So, for example, if you work with college-age students and you said something like this, I think that's a little bit more problematic, because you are communicating things that you think about a large group of people you work with. And that tells me you might not be in the organization that you need to be in. And so I think we should look at it in kind of a context-based idea about what does this say about your fit with the organization that you're with. But I think also, if you're working for a business, we also have to think about is, do you have private speech, or does everything you say and do reflect on who you work for? And I think that's also contrary to what we want to think. And so I think businesses need to be thinking about, does the way people speak, does this show that they're a good fit with our organization, or does this affect how customers will see us? Not, do I approve or disapprove of this speech? Because I think everyone wants to have a private sphere that they can call their own.
That makes sense.
No business or anything else should be able to intrude. Otherwise, we're not really individuals. We are a employee all of the time, and that's not the case.
I think that's a very helpful scheme for thinking through these issues. I want to talk more then about the way people react to these uses of speech. A lot of people, I think especially on the right, saw people saying things that were aggressive or even approving of the murder, and they feel under attack. They feel like this is a threat to them. They start to think of things less as, you know, a civil disagreement between their neighbors when they see stuff like this. What advice would you have to somebody who is beginning to think like that because of what they've seen online?
Yeah, so, first of all, I have to reiterate the people who had said things like, Charlie Kirk deserved this and everything, that's awful, that's horrendous. They never should say anything like that. That shows a inability to empathize with the other side. And I think this gets down to what we call effective polarization. The fact that we have sorted based on party, by culture, by economics, by race, and things like this, what we are seeing is that our partisanship has become a meta identity, because all of our other identities is wrapped up in that. And so what happens at times is this leads to an us versus them thinking. It's our in-group versus another group, and when someone in your group is attacked, you're thinking, are people potentially going to attack us?
Right.
And I think that's part of what this effective polarization does. It says the other side is not Americans I disagree with, the other side is the enemy. And once you think of someone as the enemy, it is a lot easier to demonize and dehumanize them. And as Christians, we always have to remember that no matter who we're talking about and what they have done, they are still a person made in the image of God, worthy of a certain amount of respect. And so people who engage in this, I hope none of them are Christians, because that's contrary to what we are called to do. And so this gets to, I'm getting off track, but
no, this is good.
I'll get to where you're going to. The idea about why it is a problem in our nation is because when we believe the other side is a threat, we become more intolerant of them. And when that happens, then we can justify even more extreme action. And that's why this effective polarization is a problem. So that's kind of on the meta level. On an individual level, what I would say is you need to take care of yourself when something like this happens. The thing I've kind of told some of my classes, something I learned from my wife, and that's the idea that life is sweet. The idea that you should sleep, drink water, exercise, eat well, and find time for Sabbath rest. And so I would think when you have things like this, it's even more important you do that, because you can get caught up in everything that is going on. And I think what you need to do in things like this is also limit your media exposure, because you're going to be introduced to things like this, and it's going to make you more fearful. It might help you catastrophize a bit, when really you should be thinking and have empathy and sympathy for the people who have lost someone who they love or respect. And so what I would suggest to people is connect with your support system, family, friends, talk to them about what's going on and how you are feeling, so you can process this. And if you continue to struggle with these kind of feelings, that's when you need to consider seeking professional help.
Well, I want to loop back around to some of what we were talking about earlier, but in that vein, what advice then would you have for maybe people who are on the other side of this equation, who maybe were very critical of Charlie Kirk, didn't like what he was doing, and they're now faced with this strange situation too, where, you know, now you have a tragedy on your hands. How would you recommend that they think about this and process this?
I would almost say they have to process it the same way. I think whenever someone has died, the first instinct is to have empathy and sympathy for them. And I think we need to be respectful of those who are mourning. Now, if you oppose someone and the things they've done or the way that they have done them, I think there is a time and a place to have that conversation. But the immediacy of the tragedy is not the time, and social media is rarely ever the place where you should have those conversations. And so if you want to do that, I say you need to wait a respectful amount of time before you have that kind of conversation about the concerns that you have about the activities or the way that they did things.
Let's talk now then about the other actor in this scenario. There's also the shooter. What do we know about the shooter? What do we know about his motivations? Does this tell us something about U.S. politics, or is this just noise?
So the individual who has been arrested for this, his name is Tyler Robinson.
Right.
He is a former straight-A student who went to Utah State for a while. He struggled there. And he, from what I understand, got caught up in an online environment and other things. And I think by his own admission, said that he killed Charlie Kirk for political reasons, that he wanted to stop Kirk from spreading hate. And so I think he was motivated by this. And so I think when we're looking at this, we should have a certain amount of sympathy for Mr. Robinson, because this is a tragedy for him and his family at the same time. I mean, he was so radicalized that he took someone's life. This is not the way it was meant to be.
Right.
And so we should mourn for the actions he takes, and mourn for his family, which is reeling from this. And we should mourn that his life is never going to be the same again. Now, this doesn't mean he doesn't deserve punishment. If he did this and he proved it, he should receive the punishment for that. But as Christians, we should also call for justice, but we should think our justice should be tempered with mercy, because we don't want to receive the just rewards of what our sin are. And so we want Mr. Robinson to receive justice, but we also don't want to let our desire for justice be so much to where we think less of him as a human, because he also is made in God's image.
So Robinson represents, you know, what might look like a worrying trend and an intensifying pattern of political violence in our society. We had the Trump assassination attempts. We had the murder of that health insurance executive. We had the murder and attempted murder of Minnesota state reps, and now a high-profile killing of a private citizen with a large platform. Are you worried about the trend in growing violence? Do you think we're entering into an era of political violence, or is this the sort of thing where I just start to highlight things that I notice because I'm looking for it now?
Yeah, I think that's something we're going to have to figure out. Right now, what I would say is, according to all the studies I've seen, is that political violence is rising. But having said that, the overall level of political violence is minuscule. And so while we can say political violence is up, so in terms of murders, I think there's only been 5 years outside of 2001, when 9/11 occurred, where 20 or more political murders have occurred. Right now we're at 25 in 2025. So that's up from like 10 to 15, but that still isn't a very large amount. And if you look at the amount of political violence as part of violent crime, it's less than 1%.
Okay.
And so I think we have to keep that in mind, that all violence is bad. It's done for the wrong reasons. Okay, most war sometimes... self-defense and other things. I mean, there are some justifications for using lethal force, but most violent crime, there isn't a good justification for it. And so I don't think it's a threat, but what we are seeing with all these attacks that you've talked about, what we are seeing is a growing trend. Actually, if we look at the Department of Homeland Security and FBI, group extremism has been declining since 2020.
Okay, now what is group extremism?
Group extremism is that groups are engaging in violence. So think of it in terms of the Antifa protests slash turns into riots during the 2020 election. See things like the Proud Boys and other things associated with J6 and things like that. That tends to go down. But what we are seeing is an increase in uptick in lone violence, the idea of a single person engaging in violence. In many of these instances, what we see occurring is these tend to be, but not always, young men. They tend to be dealing with mental issues. They tend to feel alienated from society for social, political, economic reasons. And many of these have been radicalized in an online culture that is not open to a lot of other people. And so the problem with this is these people are hard to identify, which means it's also hard to prevent them from launching attacks. But the thing we have to remember is most of these attacks are these lone attacks. It is not group motivated violence.
Right.
It still doesn't mean it's tragedy.
Oh, sure.
But it helps us think it may not be as bad as we think it is. But it's still an idea of it should all be a lesson that words matter. And while the people who pull the trigger are the ones responsible for the violence, we should always be careful about how we say things so that we don't even try to give any aid and comfort to these kinds of ideas one way or the other. This is an opportunity for everyone to step back and to realize there's a better way for this. I mean, I look at things like what happened on Sunday, and I'm like, hey, Erica Kirk is the leader we need right now, in the sense to where she says, I forgive the person who does this. Christ has called me to forgive him. I will forgive him. Charlie reached out to these kinds of people because he wanted to help them. That's what we need in a time of crisis, is someone who is going to bring down the temperature that we feel.
So you mentioned that some of this radicalization of these people takes place in online environments. It's also in online environments and on social media that we saw that you encounter somebody saying something horrible about a killing or a shooting. It's online that you might see a video of someone getting brutally murdered. I mean, we've had a couple of those recently now, including this one of Charlie Kirk. What role do you think social media is playing in these things you're talking about?
Yeah, okay, so my view is technology itself is neither good nor bad.
Mm-hmm.
How we use it is what matters. And so I think everyone should think about how they use their social media. It's fine if you're trying to advance political points of view, but what I'd say is make sure you are engaging with people who disagree with you instead of just telling people what you think they want to hear. That's what makes social media is potentially positive. It's the ability to have conversations, to grow as a person, and to reach and potentially persuade others. But yeah, there's also nothing wrong with showing the fun things you do, your interactions with friends, and everything else. But I think we should make sure that no matter how we use the technology, we use it to encourage and build up more than to tear down. And I think social media can be an accelerant. It can make things worse. But what I even want to say with that is the percent of people who do these horrible things on social media is still not most people. Most people are posting about their family, their friends, and things like that. So we should not think that this is how most people think. Because if you just look at your social media feed, you'll notice that most things on there are not political, and most of it are not harsh and degrading. Well, so don't think social media is like the real world. It's not.
It's also a mirror. If you looked at your social media and found that it was all political and all degrading, maybe you need to do some introspection with how you use the platforms, right?
Yes, yes. Absolutely.
So this has been a really valuable conversation, Sean, and I really appreciate your insights on these things. Before we go, just at the end, as a parting comment, do you want to tell us what you think this means for the health of our civil society, or how we should react to these things just in general? Because you've given a lot of really good advice in specific, but could you summarize that in a way for us?
So here's what I would say. Civil society is important. God has ordained not just government, he has ordained civil society to do things. So if you are involved in a group, I don't care if it's a sports group, a civic group, a book club, a debate club, a church, you're doing good things, and you should try to do that, because it is through civil society that we try to shape people who are in our group, but we also try to promote positive norms that will shape people outside of our group. And so we remember our calling as Christians is not just to spread the gospel. It's also to make the world we live in a better place, that we're to seek the welfare of the city in which we are living. And one of the ways that we can do this is through our social and political interactions with others.
Sean, that's a very good word. Thank you so much for your advice, and thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure. I now yield the remainder of my time.